Podcast. Thank you for having me, Joe.
Hi, welcome to the podcast. I am Joe Posnanski, and with me is Michael Shore. Michael, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
You are so welcome. You are so welcome. So we are doing something new. I don't know if it's new, but we're doing something crazy for us.
Right.
You're a busy guy. I think we all can say you're a busy person. Would you? I believe that everybody has said that. Mike Shore is a busy person.
It's one of the most famous things about me that people know about me is that I'm busy. They don't know what I'm doing, but they just have a vague sense that I'm busy.
You're involved. You're doing a lot of stuff. So to make your life easier, we're going to for a while at least, start doing what we will call mini podcasts, right? Mini, we call these micro podcasts. What do you call it?
In classic us fashion, we didn't decide what to call it at all. And now you've already thrown out two different. You should have come out strong out of the gate with like, this is what we're calling it.
Call
but
it
you've already
mini,
blown
right,
it.
Right.
It's mini or micro. Let's call it the mini cast.
Let's call it the mini cast. We're calling the mini cast. 10 minutes of high quality podcast content.
Sure.
Then we're going to actually throw an interview afterward that you like, for instance, after we do this, you'll be able to hear a wonderful interview that I did with Jay Jaffe, where we talk about the Hall of Fame, which is very fun. But we're just doing 10 minutes and we are really literally keeping this to 10 minutes. And then we'll do a little close at the end. But that's the deal. You're excited? Are we excited about this? Can we do it?
Well, here's the only question I have is it literally possible to condense the 88 minutes of nonsense that we usually engage in? Is it possible to condense that all the way down to 10 minutes? I don't know. There's so much nonsense and so much nothing. Can you crunch down that much nothing into such a small amount of time? I just don't know if it's possible based on like physics.
I don't know if physically it's possible. I do know that we haven't even started and we're already 2.5 minutes in to this.
Perfect.
So we're already a quarter of the way through our mini podcast. We haven't even started.
Well, let's get to it.
All right, we're going to focus our mini podcast this week on the Super Bowl because obviously that is coming up. But I really have sort of a specific focus, and that is everybody here who listens to this for whatever reason knows that you went into the Jaguars Patriots AFC Championship game intending fully to root for the Jaguars for any number of reasons, including the fact it's a better story, it's funnier. Even you have grown tired of all the Patriots winning. The Jaguars are so integrated in your life because of the wonderful role it plays on The Good Place, all of these reasons.
Right.
The question is, did you actually root for the Jaguars?
My head was rooting for the Jaguars and my heart was rooting for the Patriots. I found
you can't
that it
help
was
it, right.
Yeah, like it was, I kind of anticipated this a little bit. There was no way I could actively root for my team to lose with all of my being. I really did want. I mean, as the Jaguars came out and took a 10-point lead into the second deep into the second half, I really not only had made my peace with it, but was starting to like really enjoy the idea that this was going to be the outcome. And then as the Patriots mounted their comeback, it's just a fight or flight response. Like my adrenaline started pumping and my amygdala took over, my lizard brain took over. And I just wanted to watch the Patriots win. And I can't say I'm unhappy that they won, but it was a very interesting exercise in sort of like tribalism. Like you can intellectualize your way out of your tribe, but you can't emotionalize your way out of it. Like it's a very hard thing to do when you've been rooting for the team and wearing the team logo since you were old enough to be aware that sports existed. It was impossible.
Yeah, I actually find it pretty fascinating. We were texting a little bit back and forth during that day, and I was asking you because that was my gut feeling. My gut feeling was, yeah, look, you still would have been perfectly happy if the Jaguars had won. It would have been fun. It would be funny. The Super Bowl would be very different from any Super Bowl we've ever seen. All these other things. I don't think you would have felt the way you did like as a kid when they got destroyed by the Bears or something. It wouldn't have been like that. But yeah, you can't do it. I mean, right? I mean, this is, it's too much a part of who you are at this point you can't root against your team. You just can't.
No, I think you can sort of mute your interest in the team. You know, you can sort of almost go neutral. You can play dead like a possum or something in terms of how you approach the team. But I found it very hard to actively root against them. Now, I'm going to the Super Bowl. I'm going to be there. I'm taking my jerk son.
Wow.
Because he, I wasn't going to go, but then I got offered tickets. NBC has the game this year. And so they're, right. You know, they have tickets available for producers and actors and stuff. So I'm actually going. It's going to be the first football game my son has ever seen. But I have to say that on the night before, on Saturday, I bought tickets to the Timberwolves Pelicans game. And I kind of am more excited for that because I'm so into the NBA right now. And I'm kind of more excited to watch like Jimmy Butler and Karl Anthony Towns take on Anthony Davis. It's a bummer that Boogie got hurt. But the fact that I'm that excited for that, you know, NBA game in early February and not quite as excited for the Super Bowl is a sign of how muted my interest in the NFL overall actually is.
Yeah, no, I feel that. By the way, just adding another chapter to your jerk son's life, his first football game will be the Super Bowl.
His favorite team is playing, yeah. And by the way, in a span of now 3 months, he will have seen three World Series games starring his favorite team. And granted, they lost, but still three World Series games and a Super Bowl featuring his favorite football team. from October, you know, 18th to February 4th. And those World Series games are the first World Series games I ever attended in my 42 years of existence. and this is the second Super Bowl I've been to, but only like the fifth professional football game or something. It's really, again, it infuriates me.
it's so great. Look, this is what you want to do as a father, a mother. You want your children to have opportunities that you never had.
Yep.
But in 3 months for him to quadruple my life is not impressive. It's not great.
Seeing his first professional football game, he will have seen his favorite team play in more Super Bowls than you have seen your favorite team play in Super Bowls, because your favorite team has never played in the Super Bowl.
And will never go. We'll never go. All right, we're going to talk about the game here in the 2.5 minutes we have left, but I did want to make this point. You're going to see the Timberwolves Pelicans. Doesn't that still sound weird that those are NBA teams?
It does.
I was thinking about this, like stuff that were not true when we were kids. Like they still exist and we've gotten used certainly to Timberwolves or whatever, but it's not the same. And when you say a team name that wasn't around when you were a kid, it feels weird, don't you think?
Well, yes. And also it feels doubly weird because the name of the franchise should be the New Orleans Jazz.
If it were absolutely. The New Orleans Jazz,
it would be cool. It would be the best name ever. And Utah, the name of the Utah franchise should be the Utah something.
The Pelicans. Utah. That's fine. I don't care.
By the way, Pelicans makes just as much sense in Utah as Jazz does. But like the Utah, you know, Mount Razorbacks.
Wires.
But yes, the Pelicans sounds weird and the Timberwolves sounds weird. I also still, the other day I saw online somewhere someone referenced the Minnesota North Stars and thought, man, is that a better name for a hockey team?
Oh, it's so cool. Minneapolis North Lakers. Stars,
bring it back, for goodness sake.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, and well, Minneapolis Lakers. I mean, that's a better name. Look, the LA Lakers makes no sense.
Makes
no
zero
lakes
sense.
In LA? No, no sense.
The only lakes in LA are man-made and they're ugly.
And they're ugly. 1 minute. We have 1 minute to break down the Jaguars the Patriots and Eagles. Who wins the game?
I'm not just saying this. I believe the Eagles are going to win, and I don't think it's going to be particularly close. The Patriots beat two. I know the Jaguars' defense is good, but for goodness sake, they beat Blake Bortles at home. They were at home and they won. They beat Blake Bortles by 4 points. They beat the Titans handily, but come on, it's the Titans. They didn't even deserve to be there. The Eagles played better teams. They were the best team in football all year. And Nick Foles, it looks like he's exactly where Carson Wentz was, if not actually slightly better. I think the final score of this game is like my prediction is it's like 31-21 Eagles, but it's like 31-14 with 3 minutes left. And then they score, the Patriots score a late touchdown to get to within 10. That's my official call.
I hope that's true. I think that the Patriots are probably going to end up winning. I hope that you're right and I'm wrong. But I want to say one last thing about Nick Foles. I guess he's really good. So getting quarterbacks is really not that hard, no matter what anybody says.
Well, it's like, yeah, he looks really good and stuff, but he's also got a lot. That team has so many weapons. They picked up Jay Ajayi halfway through the year. They've got like two really good running backs. They've got LeGarrette Blount, who was the best running back on the last Patriots team that won the Super Bowl very recently, if you'll remember. They also have a changeup back in Jay Ajayi. They've got really good wide receivers. They've got an incredible tight end. They probably have the best offensive line in football. I mean, it's easy to look like Nick Foles did against the Vikings when you've got an incredibly good roster up and down the lineup at every position.
No question. But you have seen that stat where they compare all of Nick Foles' games versus Carson Wentz's games, and the numbers stack up like almost identical. Yeah. It's insane.
That's what I'm saying, though. It's like you put a competent person in that position with that roster and you're gonna get good results, because their offensive line is amazing. I will officially predict right now that the Patriots don't get any pressure on Foles the entire game. I don't think they have they don't have great edge rushers except for 51-year-old James Harrison, and their Eagles offensive line is just so good. I think that's going to be the difference. I think that they just can't get anywhere near Foles, and I think the Eagles will be able to get to Brady.
Yeah, I think you're right. All right, we have to end this. This is the deal. Right. So we're going to go on to my conversation with Jay Jaffe about the Hall of Fame. Very exciting. And we'll be back afterward. All right, super excited to be joined by a multiple-time guest here on the podcast now, Sports Illustrated's Jay Jaffe. Jay, first of all, welcome back. Great to have you back.
Hey, thanks, Joe. It's great to be back.
That sounded like you totally meant it, which is great.
I love to talk about my Hall of Fame stuff, and when I get to talk about my Hall of Fame stuff with one of the few people who's as big of a Hall head as myself, it's even better.
You know, two Hall of Fame nerds talking is like, it's for any other Hall of Fame nerds, assuming there are a few out there, that's the greatest thing, and for everybody else, it's like, why would you guys get a life? Just stop. Stop with the Scott Rolen. All right. Enough. So crazy. All right. We're really going to spend most of our effort, I think, talking about the future. But I do want to talk a little bit about this year's ballot. First of all, you know, you and I pretty much see eye to eye on this, on the way we think. And you've influenced my thinking a great deal. How'd you feel about this year? I mean, four guys going in: Chipper Jones, Vladimir Guerrero, Jim Thome, Trevor Hoffman, all going in. We certainly have our feelings about relief pitching and all that, but generally speaking, what do you think about this class?
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with this. You know, I think a quartet is great. The fact that it's just the fourth quartet in electoral history, but the second in 4 years, I think speaks to the urgency with which voters are, you know, have approached this. You know, I think it's neat that we got the highest votes per ballot, at least of the post 1966 era here.
Yeah. And there was, by the way, no chance before 66. People were putting a lot of people on their ballots. No chance. Right. Those guys were putting like Mantle, I guess. Maybe I'll put Mickey Mantle in here, I guess. I don't know.
It would have been awesome to see to have Edgar Martinez make it and be the fifth. But I think, you know, if you understand how the public balloting works, you had to know that that share was going to come down by election results day. You know, I think nine people with 50% or more, that ties a record. I think it just shows there's a lot of stratification now in the voting. We've got those, you know, there was that ballot, you know, that single ballot of nine guys that lots and lots of published ballots had. It was in the double digits, like sort of almost a group think, but it was so obvious, I think, for most people to identify nine guys. And then there's a big fall off to, you know, as to how people use that 10th vote. And obviously there are variants and otherwise, but, you know, I had a ballot that went completely unrepresented my virtual ballot went completely unrepresented until the final days when I think Ken Davidoff was the only one who turned in one that matched mine.
Right. And really the thing that the difference between our ballots, for instance, is just one guy. You went with Andrew Jones, right? I mean, that was right. That was the guy. And I think I went with Larry Walker. No, you have Walker on your ballot.
I had Walker. Yeah.
Who are your 10?
I did not have either Vlad or Trevor Hoffman.
Oh, because Vlad.
I'm perfectly comfortable with Vlad Guerrero in the Hall of Fame. He does not do particularly well in Jaws.
Right.
And so, you know, if I'm making an argument that's based on using my system as a tool, he is not the best advertisement for that. But you know, I don't begrudge his spot. I think it's really cool that he broke the second year percentage that belonged to Roberto Alomar before, and that he was the it's amazing he passed Tomy in terms of getting the second highest percentage of this group, because Tomy was, you know, an obvious first ballot guy.
Yeah, it was very interesting. And look, I think that there are more problems with Vladimir Guerrero's overall case when you compare it historically with other people in the Hall, because of various issues, various things about the way he played. But man, he was just so much fun and such a credit to the game. I mean, it's, you know, that's where it gets to be interesting. But yeah, I think that was the only difference, was that I had Vladimir Guerrero on mine and you had Andrew Jones on yours. And you know, look, these are fascinating calls that we're making now. That's really the thing. I mean, I felt the same way. I felt there were 9 guys that I was super duper stoked about, you know, voting for, that I just felt like, oh, these guys, yes, definite, yes, yes, yes. I did not vote for Vladimir Guerrero his first year. I had Manny Ramirez instead. Uh-huh. And I didn't, I regretted it. I just felt like Manny Ramirez, you know, look, we can discuss if we want to. I don't know if we're going to want to go into the whole PED issue again. We've done that before. But to me, the problem with Manny is at a time when we all knew at this point, stop using it. Right. I mean, it's
right.
There's testing. It's an embarrassment to the game in a very public way. It's a threat to the game in various ways. To test positive twice in this testing era is bad. It's bad. And I'm not saying it should disqualify him, because I don't think it should. I think we still have to look at Manny Ramirez, although I don't know that his numbers are going to go very far. But that was – so I felt like, look, Vladimir Guerrero just – so I had 9, and then for me it was a question of who to put as the 10th guy. How would you say that you looked – at the issues ballot, like the people that you were like, absolutely have to be on my ballot?
Yeah, I especially felt like, okay, so I think the first thing is that I'm inclusive of Bonds and Clemens. For me, the PED issue is one that's larger than individual players deciding to be bad actors. It's an institutional failure, and I don't think you can penalize the individuals who took advantage of that before Major League Baseball had a policy in place that actually deterred, you know, with suspensions and testing. So they're on there. Then obviously Chipper and Jim Tomy, easy first ballot choices. The two pitchers, Messina and Schilling, easy choices for me.
Yes.
Edgar Martinez, Larry Walker, very easy choices for me based on the analytics. So that's 8. If I think I'm counting right here, then the other two were analytics choices for me. Andrew Jones, Scott Rolen.
Scott Rolen, right? Yeah.
Scott Rolen's defense is just, you know, remarkable, and it's rare to see the numbers and the reputation align. What I don't understand for the life of me is why Scott Rolen gets dismissed as a hitter, and that combo gets dismissed so easily. If Scott Rolen was hitting like Omar Vizquel, would he get 37%?
Right.
You know, this is the problem that I wrote about in my Hall of Fame book, the Cooperstown Casebook. It's that voters have a very particularly hard time acknowledging the the difficulty of third basemen to be outstanding contributors on both sides of the ball. I mean, it's, you know, he's kind of a Ron Santo type with better fielding numbers. You know, I don't think people appreciated Scott Rowland's offense enough. I think they dinged him a little too much for the length of his career and for his injuries. Despite that, this is a guy who's got 70 WAR, you know, and a pretty solid 70 WAR, and was, you know, a human highlight film. I think people, you know, it's like people are like, no, he was never a franchise player. The Phillies offered the guy $140 million. Over 10 years. That's not a franchise player. Look at the contract he signed with the Cardinals. It's an 8-year deal. That's not a franchise player. That's a franchise player. I mean, you know, if you've already got Albert Pujols, okay, maybe he's not the number one franchise player, but obviously he's a huge guy. And as for Jones, you know, his fielding numbers are number one in among center fielders based on what Baseball Reference uses, which is the combination of total zone and defensive runs saved. And I know that you know, very smart people can quibble with that. Bill James is particularly vocal about Andrew Jones, the quality of his defense, and the impropriety of comparing across eras when you don't have the same metrics. I get that. And I think I know Chris Dial, who does one of the systems that goes into the sabermetric portion of the Gold Gloves, says that Jones's defense was overrated too. Okay, fine. To me, you know, we look at those the big trio of Braves pitchers who got in from the dynasty: Glavine, Maddux, and Smoltz. Of those three, only Smoltz was a real strikeout pitcher. The other two guys were just, you know, absolute craftsmen, artists, whatever you want to call it, who put a lot of balls in play. And there was no player who had a bigger role in snuffing out those balls in play than Andrew Jones. He was the constant for them for so long, and just an elite defender. And, you know, if we found out today that Andrew Jones was 3 or 4 years older than his birthday. That his birth certificate or whatever Major League Baseball has on file indicates, we would understand Andrew Jones's career so much better, and it would be easier to vote for him in the Hall of Fame. If he debuted at 23 and was done in his late 30s and done as a productive player in his mid 30s, I think we'd all understand that career pattern a lot better, and we wouldn't sit there wondering what might have been.
Yeah, no, I think that's 100% right, and I want to talk about all three of those guys that you just mentioned. When we talk about Omar Vizquel, we talk about Scott Rowland, and we talk about Andrew Jones, because I think there's a strong comparison to be made for all of those and sort of the weirdness of the voting. But for one more minute, I want to spend on this year's ballot, and then we can get to that. One of the weirdest things that I've never quite been able to get my arms around is that certain relief pitchers – And this is not specific to Trevor Hoffman, although this is Trevor Hoffman this year for sure. But Bruce Sutter was like this. Raleigh Fingers was like this. In some ways, Dennis Eckersley was like this, although that was a strange career because he spent, you know, so much of it as a good starter before he ever even started as a reliever. We don't even ask the question whether or not they belong in the Hall of Fame. It's like they transcend the question. Like a guy like Gossage was on the ballot forever, and eventually everybody said, well, you know, Gossage was probably better than Raleigh Fingers, and he was probably better than Bruce Sutter, so he should be in the Hall of Fame. You know, it was like the thought process that followed made a lot of sense to me. You know, right, whether or not you would think he should be in the Hall or not, it was a thought process. There was no thought process with putting Trevor Hoffman in the Hall of Fame. He got 70% of the vote his first year. So it was very clear that from the literal get-go that Trevor Hoffman was going to go to the Hall of Fame. And I'm not quibbling with that at all. If that's how people feel, if they love the save, look, the relief pitcher is an important right. part of the game. I didn't vote for him, but I perfectly get why other people did. What I don't get is, why did Trevor Hoffman transcend the conversation while Billy Wagner sits at 10%, 11%, and probably isn't going anywhere, and nobody nobody even wants to talk about him. Like, how come he didn't get to skip 12 grades? I don't get that.
I agree with you. And I mean, for me, I think I may have had Hoffman on my virtual ballot last year. I can't quite recall. I know I considered him, and I would not have had him in my top 10. But I get why, I get why he's going in. And to me, it goes beyond the saves. Goes beyond the saves total. And, both Hoffman and Wagner, incidentally, are tied in Jaws at 24 points, tied for 20th all time. And that you've got Eckersley among the Hall of Fame relievers. You've got Eckersley, Wilhelm, Gossage, and Suter ahead of both of them.
Yes.
And it's a matter of innings thrown. Hoffman had slightly more innings than Bruce Suter by about 57 total. There's not a huge difference between them. There's less than 1 point of Jaws. There's a big distance between both of those guys and Gossage. To me, what it came down to, when I became much more comfortable with Trevor Hoffman when I started looking at alternative ways to view the relievers, and I've never been entirely satisfied with the way that whatever wins above replacement stat I'm using used to be the BP WARP, right. and now it's BREF WAR. Does with capturing relievers. I don't think it gives enough credit for leverage. But as it turns out, Trevor Hoffman is number two all-time in win probability added to Mariano Rivera. That credits him for all those one-run games, even if he was pitching only the ninth inning with nobody on base.
Sure.
And in a relatively low-scoring environment such as was produced by Petco Park in an age of very high scoring. I think that maybe overstates his case a little bit, but you understate it one way and you overstate it another way. It comes out to be, I think, a reasonably worthy Hall of Famer. Billy Wagner is like fifth or sixth in that. There are some additional leverage adjusted stats you can throw in there that kind of solidify his spot there among the top half dozen relievers of all time. I think he's very worth it. I think on a ballot this crowded, it's very tough to find room for one reliever. So finding room for two is inconceivable. For most people, I do think that Wagner's got one more year to withstand with Mariano Rivera going in. But after that, he's the best reliever we're going to see on the ballot for a while. I mean, I think you look at Joe Nathan and Jonathan Papelbon and Francisco Rodriguez, who are, it's not 100% clear that they're done, but of those guys, only K-Rod pitched in the majors last year. So the countdown has already begun on the other two guys. They're the next tier, and I wouldn't take any of those guys over Wagner.
Right.
They had stretches where they were good, but Wagner was just great for so long. And he walked away under his own power at just a point when he turned in one of his best seasons. The stats of total dominance really favor him. I'm hopeful for Billy Wagner. His profile that I wrote for my SI series is one of my favorites. Because I went into it like, this guy's not a Hall of Famer, but let's look. And I was like, oh, geez. You start with the fact that he was actually born right-handed and kept breaking his arm and learned to throw left-handed and threw left-handed with that heat. And like the highest strikeout rate and lowest opponent's batting average of anybody at that level of innings or higher. And it's like, oh, Billy Wagner.
Yeah.
Holy crap. I mean, we got to talk about Billy Wagner. And there's so many, we grew up around the same time. There's so many great and, interesting relievers that we were treated to in the 70s and 80s, guys like Kent Tekulve and Dan Quisenberry. And, sure. It was kind of the emergence of the modern relief ace, really flowered. The Rolaids relief man. I mean, Sparky Lyle winning the Cy Young Award. Tug McGraw being one of the most quotable guys in baseball. There were so many of those guys. And I think Billy Wagner, boy, if he'd pitched in the 70s or 80s, and put up the kind of numbers he put up, he'd be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, look, I think you can have a very open conversation about what you should do with relief pitchers. One thing that I don't like is when people say, well, if a relief pitcher is a specialist, then a DH is a specialist. How can you vote for a DH? Well, we haven't voted for a DH. No, I mean, there are no DHs in the Hall of Fame. I mean, Frank Thomas is the closest thing to a DH, and he basically spent almost half his career at first base. Tommy, the same thing. I mean, it's like there are no DHs in the Hall of Fame, but we have five or six relievers in the Hall of Fame. So My feeling about the situation with relief pitchers, from my personal viewpoint, is in order to get in the Hall of Fame, you have to transcend the position.
Yeah.
Like, the position is limiting in and of itself. So the best reliever, it's sort of like some years, the Pulitzer Prize will, like, they'll say, like, for best feature or something, they'll just say no winner. They'll just say no, right. Nothing was good enough this year to do. Well, that's sort of how I feel. It's like, just because you were the best relief pitcher does not mean you belong in the Hall of Fame. Did you transcend the position? Mariano Rivera unquestionably transcended the position. Trevor Hoffman, if you want to make the argument that he transcended the position, okay. How do you not make the argument that Billy Wagner did? I don't see, you know, your point about Wagner, highest strikeout percentage, lowest batting average against. He has the lowest WHIP, walks and hits per innings pitched in baseball history. I mean, since dead ball. Yeah. I mean, this is it's insane. It's insane. He was truly one of the most unhittable pitchers any of us have ever seen. For an extended period of time, doing it year after year after year. So if you're going to vote Trevor Hoffman in, if he transcends, then Billy Wagner transcends. And to me, transcends in a greater way, in my view. But this is where we start talking about next year's ballot. Next year, Mariano Rivera comes on, and you've given one possibility, which is Rivera's going to go in. He's going to go in nearly unanimously. It's going to be a big celebration. It's going to be great. After he leaves, Billy Wagner will be the best reliever on the ballot probably for the next 5 years. So will this, A, make Billy Wagner a viable Hall of Fame candidate where he will start climbing in total, or, because we've seen this happen too, will basically Mariano Rivera reset the standards for what a relief pitcher needs to be, and suddenly Billy Wagner is nowhere near. This is what happened to Louis Tiant. Louis Tiant was absolutely at, you know, whether or not you think he belongs in the Hall or not, he was at the Hall of Fame level. The voters gave him a pretty high percentage his first year. Then a whole bunch of 300-game winners came along, and suddenly Louis Tiant was out of the game. So does that sort of thing happen to Billy Wagner, or does Billy Wagner actually benefit from the whole thing being cleared and him being on the stage alone?
Yeah, that's a good question. When I looked at my five-year outlook, I couldn't really find room for him. But then I was kind of, by 2021, which is incidentally the first year I'll get my ballot, you know, it's all up in the air just because we've got such stratification here between the over 50% guys and the under 50% guys. You've only got two guys between Curt Schilling, number 9 at 51.2% this year, and Fred McGriff, number 12 at 23.2% in his ninth year, and their Vizquel, a first-year candidate, and Larry Walker, an eighth-year candidate, who's not going to make it to 75% by the end. So you're left with figuring out, like, who's going to rise? Jeff Kent, Gary Sheffield, Billy Wagner, Scott Rolen, Andrew Jones. I mean, there's from a standpoint of precedent, looking at how voters have handled guys who are, you know, down below 20% in their nth year on the ballot, there's just not much to go by. I mean, none of these guys is Burt Blyleven, you know, level even, or Duke Snider level even. You know, so it's tough to see how that's going to play out. And, you know, we're really just guessing, I think, even more so than, you know, than you look back a couple of years. So
it's interesting. It really is. It's going to be interesting. All right, let's talk about next year's ballot. And then I want to get back to the conversation of the three guys. There are, in my view, there are between three and four very interesting newcomers next year. And I'm looking at your jaw system for each of them. So that's going to be interesting to discuss as well. Mariano Rivera is interesting, but only because he's going to go in slam dunk, right? There's, he's going to get more. If I give you over under of 95%, is he over or under?
I think somewhere between, I would take the over, but only slightly.
Okay. So you do think a bunch of people,
like
20 people, will not vote for him because of the relief pitcher thing or whatever.
Yeah, I think so. Especially if we've still got no mandatory transparency.
Yeah, well, there you go. I would not want to be the one to vote against Mariano Rivera. Right. That doesn't make a lot of sense. All right, so here are the three guys that I think are very interesting. It starts certainly with Roy Halladay. I was surprised Roy Halladay does not quite match up in jaws to the position. He's a little bit below. His jaws is 57.6. By the way, jaws being a combination of career value and peak value. That's the idea.
Yeah, if you'll allow me to explain on how that, well, it's just that. It's the combination of career and peak. Roy Halladay's peak is a Hall of Fame peak, no doubt.
Yes.
He is within, I think he's about half a win over the 7-year wins above replacement total of the average Hall of Fame starter. He does that with an innings total of 2,749 and a third, which, you know, sounds like a big number, but really isn't. The only starter in recent memory who's gone in with fewer than 3,000 innings via the writers is Pedro Martinez. And we all know that Pedro Martinez was, you know, just about the best pitcher of his era. I mean, you on a batter for batter basis, you can make a case that he is the best pitcher ever. All those things we were talking about, Billy Wagner, you know, at his level of innings, Pedro Martinez at his level of innings against the degree of difficulty he was facing,
incredible,
is the man.
It's incredible.
So Roy Halladay, because of the mess he made out of his early career, in part, really not only not qualifying for an ERA title for the first time until he's 25 years old and had put up that 10.64 ERA a couple years earlier, and had just, you know, kind of been stuck in sort of a swingman role for a couple years and up and down to AAA for a couple years, and maybe there was an injury in there, I'm forgetting offhand. You've got that, and then you've got him disappearing from the majors at age 36 after throwing just 52 innings.
It just ended with it.
And even, you know, the year before that, just 156 innings. So you've got really only about a 10 or 11 years of solid major league service, and it's very tough to mount a strong Hall of Fame case in that. And so he comes up short in the career wins above replacement department, relative to the average Hall of Famer by about 9 wins, roughly, you know, one per year over that stretch. It's still a great career. And to me, it's not just that, but it's also the perspective of what's coming after, which is not much. You look at the pitchers who are, you know, the other guy hitting the ballot next year, I'm sure you're probably going to mention, is Andy Pettitte. With his 256 career wins and a whole bunch of interesting postseason moments and things like that. You know, Andy Pettitte was not a run preventer in the same way that Roy Halladay was. Andy Pettitte didn't win any Cy Young awards. He never threw any no hitters. You know, he does not have the things that Halladay has. You know, Mark Burley, another guy who is, I think, hits the ballot a couple years after that. Just kind of, you know, more in the Pettitte class there. There aren't anything close to a slam dunk guy, really, until we get to Clayton Kershaw. We have to see how the late careers of a number of guys like Zach Greinke, CC Sabathia, Justin Verlander all play out. You know, one of those guys, I think, you know, if they survive and pitch into their late 30s, early 40s, even, I think is going to have the numbers, but not all of those guys. And I think we're sort of waiting for the electorate to reckon with what I'm calling the workload constraint era, which is not just the permanent move to the 5-man rotation, but also the pitch count and innings caps issues that these pitchers face. They can't, you know, the complete game is basically gone. Roy Halladay was kind of the last of his type, the guy who was going to complete 10 starts a year or whatever. You know, these other guys, I mean, they're great pitchers, but they've also experienced big divots in their careers due to injuries that look like they may be counted out or something. And even those guys are remarkable compared to what's come after them. You look at, you know, it's just, there's like, look at the free agent market right now. There's no number one starter. There's no obvious number one starter right now. You dial back a couple of years. Think of when was it David Price and Johnny Cueto and
right?
Was it Max Scherzer? Was that all the same year? Scherzer
might be a year.
Scherzer, yeah, you're right. Scherzer, yeah. But you know, like David Price has already fallen pretty far in the 2 years under his contract. Max Scherzer's held up remarkably well and has probably pitched himself into that position in part because Clayton Kershaw's gotten hurt, and Scherzer now has as many Cy Youngs, three.
Right.
But Johnny Cueto, another big money free agent, has fallen off the map. Felix Hernandez, who, you know, at one point looked like he was going to be a 300 game winner, has fallen off the map. There's just not a lot of starting pitching options if you look at the next 10 years. And boy, Roy Halladay looks absolutely fantastic when you place him in that context and the context of Hall pitchers. But it also just leads me to go look back at Mike Messina and Curt Schilling. And like, what do these guys have to do?
Yeah.
I mean, finally, Messina's up above 60% and he looks like he's trending towards election in a couple of years. And Schilling has regained some ground, and we don't need to dwell on why Curt Schilling has lost ground.
Right.
But you know, he obviously has. So I think in that regard, Roy Halladay particularly stands out to me as a guy who I think is a must. And I think, you know, the unfortunate tragedy of his untimely death has probably accelerated his path to election. I think he's a first ballot guy now. I think when I look back at what I wrote a year ago, I had him taking 3 or 4 years to get in.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think all of that's right. By the way, one of the things I love about Jaws is that it does look at a career total and looks at a peak, 7 year peak. I really wish that as voters look at starting pitchers these days, they start looking a lot more at peak and a lot less a career total, because we're just not – your point is 100% right. Look, Clayton Kershaw, to me, Clayton Kershaw does not have to pitch another inning to be a Hall of Famer. You know, I mean, he clearly was the dominant pitcher of our time, and to me, he's in the Hall of Fame. He's a Hall of Famer right now. And yet, if he came out right now, you would be looking at how many wins he had and this and that and the other. And I just think that's such an outdated way of looking at it. And I think Roy Halladay is an absolute Hall of Famer. I will vote for him. He's the first ballot guy for me. But I don't think Roy Halladay was a better pitcher than Johan Santana.
Oh, boy. I really don't. Yeah, I think you could put – yeah, we could have that – what we just talked about there applies to Johan Santana. I mean, I think Santana has about 700 fewer innings than Halladay and did not have the chance even to get Roy Halladay's peak. I mean, like if you define peak as a 5-year thing, he's right there. Unfortunately for Santana in my system, I use 7 years. I originally used 5 consecutive, which boy, Halladay would look, I mean, Santana would look great if you used, 04 to 08. My God. Just excuse the clicking here for a second. I just want to total that up. That's, 35.4 WAR in a 5-year span, 7.1, average over those 5 years. That's
amazing.
That's wow. And then you think Halladay did average more than 7 over 7 years. For 5 years, Johan Santana is right there with him. And another guy who I loved working on his profile, and I was also like, man, there's no way this guy's going to survive even to year 2 on this ballot. You know, so this is my best chance to make his case and have him cast into the void alongside Kenny Lofton and the other one and done guys.
I just think there are a bunch of pitchers. I mean, in recent years, like David Cone, like Brett Saberhagen, like Johan Santana, like Kevin Brown, although Kevin Brown's his own story, who, if you look at them and say, okay, at their best, when you look at the best of Brett Saberhagen or the best of David Cone, are they not as good as John Smoltz? Are they not as good as Tom Glavine? Are they not as good as all these guys that we've been putting in the Hall of Fame in recent years? And then that's why you do need, okay, you got to do it for an extended period of time. And I get that. I really do. And I'm not trying to make the case. Roy Halladay has a better Hall of Fame case than Johan Santana, but I just think it's funny. We're kind of splitting hairs a little bit because Roy Halladay, I think, has a very good chance of going in first ballot, and Johan Santana didn't get 3% of the vote.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's, it's just strange. It's just strange how we, how we judge it. And there are plenty of people in the Hall of Fame, as you and I both know, who aren't as good as either of them.
Right.
You know, I mean, they just managed to last a long time. So it's an interesting topic that we should probably hit another time.
Well, yeah, before we do, I just want to note one thing. I mean, just the fates of the two-time Cy Young winners. I mean, just to read a list here. You've got Bob Gibson, obvious Hall of Famer. Tom Glavine, 300-game winner, Hall of Famer. Gaylord Perry, 300-game winner, Hall of Famer. And then you've got Halliday, Santana, Sabre Hagen, Denny McLean, Tim Lincecum, and Corey Kluber. I mean, that is just – like you could write a hell of a book about the fates of those – the careers and the fates of those nine guys and what happened to them. And I think it would be it would make for an interesting read and an engrossing one. Just the range of possibilities that could happen to people. I mean, Tim Lincecum, you know, his career is in oblivion. He's never even going to get 2.4% on the Hall of Fame ballot. I'm not even sure he's got his 10 years, to be perfectly honest, as I sit here. Yes, he does. He does have exactly 10 years now. So
10 years.
He could appear on a ballot, and he will.
All right, here's one for you. Somebody asked me this question point blank because I've said my feeling about how much more valuable in my mind starters are, and that no offense to Trevor Hoffman, I don't think he was as good a pitcher as Johan Santana. I just don't think he was. And somebody asked me that question. They said, would you take the career of Tim Lincecum or the career of Trevor Hoffman? And, you know, that's a fascinating question. You know,
depends
on what you mean. What would I take? Would I take as a player – If I got to be one of those guys, certainly I'd want to be Trevor Hoffman. I mean, right?
Trevor Hoffman has like, you know, postseason negatives, I think, attached to him. And that's one of the big knocks. And Tim Lincecum, big part of a couple titles there. That comes with the territory. And I think, I don't know, maybe it's not fair. Maybe this isn't fair to Hoffman. Was Hoffman as beloved by the Padres fans at his peak as Lincecum was by Giants fans at his peak? Maybe so.
Yeah.
And certainly for longer because of his staying power. If I'm a GM,
I hate to tell, you know, I mean, because again, I don't want it to sound like I'm knocking Trevor Hoffman, because I'm not. But if I'm a GM, I'm taking Tim Lincecum. I mean, look, I can mostly replace Trevor Hoffman. Maybe I can't get as good as Trevor Hoffman. He was terrific. But I can, you know, you look at the Braves during all the years they won the championships, they had a different closer every year.
Right.
If I could figure out a way to replace my closer much, much easier than I could to get, even for 4 years, you know, the best pitcher on the planet. Right.
Right?
I mean, that feels to me like I would rather have the start.
Yeah, you know, so, nothing tells me about the relative difficulty of closing as the fact that Bud Norris saved 19 games last year.
That's a fact. That's a fact. All right. I want to ask you about Todd Helton, and then I want to go to our three guys because that's where we're going to close this thing out. Todd Helton was one heck of a hitter, just a fantastic hitter. He also played in Colorado, and we've seen what happened to Larry Walker, who was it drives me insane that Larry Walker can't get any real momentum going. What's going to happen? First, I'll ask you what's going to happen, then what should happen to Todd Helton?
Well, I think Helton is in for an uphill battle. I mean, you know, you look at what's happened with Walker. He didn't break even 25% of the vote until this year when he got 34%. And he isn't going to get to, you know, 75% by the time his 10 years are up. He'll be lucky to get to 50%, although I do think that there may be, you know, enough momentum. Helton looks like a guy who's probably going to be in Fred McGriff territory in the low 20s. Because people, it's easy to discount his numbers because he spent his entire career in Colorado. We don't have much basis to say, oh, well, look at what Walker did in St. Louis and look at what Walker did in Montreal. And, Larry Walker's all around skills as a defender and a base runner. Todd Helton is kind of one dimensional, actually, that's not fair. Todd Helton was a good defender. He did his gold gloves. He's got a few of them. He's plus 74 runs here.
He was a good defender, but he was a first
baseman. He's a better defender than I remember him being. Less so in the mind's eye than more just looking at these looking over these numbers and kind of re-solidifying their place in my mind. Problem with Todd Helton is, you know, there's two problems. One, to me, I don't think his 30s were that impressive. He had some down years in his 30s. Only had 20 home runs once in his 30s after age 30, and that's in that most favorable hitting environment. And you know, he's being judged against first baseman, and first baseman, you got to bring it. You got to bring the heavy lumber, and he didn't even have 400 home runs. 369 career homers. So I don't see Todd Helton getting a ton of traction here.
I'll tell you one thing though, 592 doubles. That's impressive.
Oh, yeah, look, Todd Helton's numbers are impressive. 133 career OPS plus, the 414 career on base percentage. The guy could hit. But maybe it's unfair. Look, you know, Larry Walker won an MVP award. Todd Helton never finished higher than fifth in the voting, was not regarded as even, you know, that type of player.
I think Todd Helton is a problematic case for a lot of reasons, including the fact that he really did fall off after age 35 and didn't put up the big career totals that you want. That 2000 season that he finished fifth in the MVP.
You're right.
Oh my God. Right.
Slash stat, triple crown, 372, 463, 690. I mean, that's a Larry Walker peak season there.
Yeah, Stan Musial. The guy 59 doubles.
59 doubles, 147 RBIs. That's just 405 total bases. Yes, that is a Stan Musial season there. those are just silly video game numbers.
They are.
I can see him being dinked for the fact that he didn't drive in 100 runs once he passed age 30. Once he reached his 30th birthday, he didn't drive in 100 runs. And like, boy, that's if you're supposed to be an offensive cornerstone and you're looking at old school stats, he's in trouble there.
By the way, how does somebody hit 347 with 32 home runs and 49 doubles and not drive in 100 runs? Bad was that team around?
Yeah, it's that, and it's also that he walked 127 times.
So he did walk 127
times. You've got sort of the Joey Votto problem there. In that the walks start to be held against you, and the high on base percentage starts to be held against you because you're not driving in runs. And runs are better in baseball games.
We have heard that.
I mean, it's like you've got. Look, I just pulled up the 2004 Rockies page since we're talking about it. You've got a lousy age 24 season from Matt Holliday. You've got an okay age 36 season from Vinny Castilla. You've got Helton's great year there. And you've got a pretty solid season from Jeremy Burnitz in right field. And those are the only full-timers who contributed an OPS plus that was above average.
Above average.
Yeah. You've got late stage Charles Johnson, terrible Aaron Miles and Royce Clayton in the middle infield from an offensive standpoint, really bad partial season from Preston Wilson there in center field. And just, you know, despite all the advantages that this Rockies had offensively, they finished fourth in scoring. I mean, you know, it takes some doing
By the way, that year, Vinny Castilla drove in 131.
Yes.
And Jeremy Burnitz drove in 110. How many of those were Todd Helton?
Right.
You know, I mean, it's like Todd Helton was was out there all the time. Yeah. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see. All right. I want to wrap this up. I want to let you have the rest of the day to yourself. But we have to talk about those three guys because I think they connect very, very strongly. There are three players that will be on next year's ballot. Hopefully on ballots to come, we'll see how that plays out. Who their case is this, in a general way. They were uniquely gifted defensive players in their time and in baseball history. They were uniquely gifted defensive players. They were good enough offensively that once you add their defense to the mix, they are Hall of Famers. That is the argument for all three of these guys. Okay. So the first guy on that list, the guy that got the highest percentage, this year by far of the three is Omar Vizquel. So Omar Vizquel, the entire case for Omar Vizquel is he was a unique defensive shortstop, the best of his time, one of the best of all time in the picture, if not in the same room, but in the picture with Ozzie Smith. And offensively, lots and lots and lots of hits, right? He had 2,800 plus hits. That's his case. The second guy is Andrew Jones, incredible defensive center fielder. As you mentioned, some stats show him the greatest of all time. Certainly the best of his time. Nobody ever disputed that or doubted at the time. Won a bunch of gold gloves. And then his defensive numbers are off the charts. Plus 400 home runs. He wasn't a great offensive player, but he did hit 400 home runs. Did almost win an MVP. And so you say, good enough offensively. When you add in the defense, he's in the Hall. And the third guy is Scott Rolen. And Scott Rolen is certainly the best offensive player of that group. But it's the same general case. Greatest defensive third baseman, maybe, with Adrian Beltre, but one of the all-time great defensive third basemen. And then very, very good hitter, better hitter than the other two guys. Probably would not be a Hall of Famer if he was a mediocre left fielder. He didn't hit that well. But considering his great defensive third, Hall of Famer. So why are these three guys breaking out the way that they are, where Rolen and Jones both were very, very low on the ballot? Jones almost fell off the ballot. And Omar Vizquel is clearly on his way to, 37%. That's very, very good for a first year. What happened?
Yeah, first of all, if I'm not mistaken, it was the unpublished ballots, according to Ryan Thibodeau, the percentages might have shifted now, but both Barry Bonds and Omar Vizquel got the same 44% on the unpublished ballots.
Amazing.
One of them finished with 56%. One of them finished with 37% in the final numbers. I think that is amazing. Omar Vizquel is a lot of flashy marketing and maybe a little bit of revisionism here. He was legitimately a very watchable player defensively. He came along at a time when the nightly highlight shows were in their heyday. And so whether it's Web Gems or MLB TV, MLB.com highlights, we have no shortage of great footage of Omar Vizquel. He was a beloved elder statesman who stuck around until he was about 56 years old and was still a pretty reasonably good defensive player. So he accumulated some high totals in hits, 2,877, and most games played for a shortstop. I think it's very easy to look at the slash line and the hits total and think, oh yeah, he's kind of like Ozzie Smith. He's pretty much Ozzie Smith, without really taking into account the breadth of Ozzie Smith's skills as a base runner, which were considerable and which like do a lot to distance himself from Omar Vizquel, and it's the fact that Omar played in a very high scoring era and Ozzie in a very low scoring one, and so hitting 270 had very with the peripheral stats they had very different meanings and very different values. The defensive numbers don't make a strong case for Omar as you'd think. There's about, I think the Baseball Reference ones have Omar in about the top dozen shortstops of all time, which is very respectable. And sure, you can argue that maybe they're shortchanging him a little bit, but there's still about 100-run gap between him and Ozzie Smith on the defensive side. And then it turns out there's about another more than that on the offensive side, and especially when you consider the base running. I just don't think he's the exemplar of the good field, no hit guy to be in the Hall of Fame. By jaws, he's about the equivalent of the worst, Hall of Fame shortstop in that regard, Rabbit Moranville. It's tough for me to get, to feel a strong urge to elect him. You go back, you look at the way he was thought of in terms of all-star appearances and MVP voting, a 16th place MVP finish, three all-star appearances, obviously, and this guy had a ton of exposure as being part of those great Indians teams that were perennial postseason contenders. And like I said, he had that sort of elder statesman tour that, you know, with the Giants especially. But it's just, it feels like it's less than the sum of its parts to me because that batting is so bad.
Well, let me say this, because look, I love Omar Vizquel. I mean, I'm a Clevelander.
Sure.
Loved watching him play. Love him. This, I don't get it. And of course, when I start talking like this, I come off as an Omar Vizquel hater, and I'm not. I love the guy. I think he's fantastic. I don't get it at all. And your point that you just made is the one that, to me, people who compare Omar Vizquel to Ozzie Smith are missing many, many things like you talk about. They're missing base running. You're missing that Ozzie was a much, much better fielder. All of these other things. That's all fine and good. Here's the thing that I don't get about the argument. When we watched Ozzie Smith play, and I mean when we as a collective watched him play, we got it. The guy was the all-star shortstop every single year. Every single year, he was the top vote getter at shortstop. He started, what, 10 out of 11 years, he was the starting shortstop in the National League. He almost won the MVP in 87 and probably should have won the MVP considering the voting and how it went in 87. He was the biggest, one of the biggest stars in the game while he played. We didn't have to wait for him to retire before anybody said, oh, you know what? He was really underappreciated. He was a gigantic, gigantic star. Everybody knew Ozzie Smith. Everybody wanted to be Ozzie Smith. None of that's true about Omar Vizquel. Yes. None of it. He never started an all-star game. He never started one all-star game.
Yeah.
And look, he was terrific, but you tell me how Omar Vizquel is better than Dave Concepcion,
right?
Or better than, you know, Bert Campanaris, or better than about five other shortstops you can name who were terrific fielders. They were all excellent fielding shortstops. They hit at least as well, or if not better than what you would expect from the position. Then I just don't get it. I don't know where this Omar Vizquel stuff came from, and it's fine. Look, if Omar Vizquel, people want to vote for Omar Vizquel, you know, like I said, I love the guy. But man, I don't get this. I just don't understand it at all. Even Jack Morris had like the biggest, most wins in the 80s and all those opening day starts and you know, the great postseason performances. And you're like, okay, well, maybe I agree, maybe I disagree. Now he's in the Hall of Fame, so that conversation finally can get to bed. But I got it. I got why people saw this. I don't even get this. I don't even understand it.
Yeah, it's an incredibly polarizing debate. And unfortunately, you know, as was the case with Jack Morris, it feels like when we dig in our heels to argue against whether he's whether he's one of the top 1% of all time or merely one of the top 5% of all time, we're expending a lot of energy to argue that. And you have to, because some people are just so insistent on ignoring the actual evidence in favor of their own subjective points of view. And it's just, it's probably the most, the least appealing part of this whole thing is like,
I agree.
You know, it's like you have to, you know, you may, I don't want to say talk in hyperbole because I think I've maybe tried to tame myself from that as my point of view has become one that a larger share of the electorate listens to. You know, I try to play it straight here so that the clarity is not lost. But yeah, I don't get it with Omar Vizquel. I do think that, you know, there's like David Concepcion, I think, is a great comparison. I wanted to believe David Concepcion was a Hall of Fame shortstop because I have such fond memories of watching him. And you think, you know, the big red machine and what they meant to baseball and Concepcion with that bounce throw and all that. And the fact is, David Concepcion doesn't measure it very well, and that he and Omar Vizquel are about three notches apart in jaws. Omar actually does have the advantage there.
Might played longer.
Yeah, I played. And David Concepcion is a guy who fell just, you know, half a season short of 10,000 plate appearances. That's not a short career at all. But he was a nine-time All-Star, and he was still doing it. You know, when Ozzie came along. It feels unfortunate to me that Vizquel is going to be a symbol One thing that bothers me, though, I have to say, for all of this Omar Vizquel was a great guy thing, the Jose Mesa thing really, really galls me.
It was pretty nasty.
It really nasty. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't think you can, you know, I think you as fans, we understand the notion of heroes and goats. Once you're in, you know, once you're inside the game and you actually talk to these people and you know that like the honest effort was there, I don't think you can call a guy out like that, call a teammate out like that.
It was a pretty nasty. I think it really was.
Kurt Schilling making an ass out of himself and hiding under a towel when Mitch Williams threw fine. You know, I mean, Mitch Williams was walking the ballpark every time. Okay, yeah. You look at Mitch Williams' numbers, and there's no way that guy would get a chance today, walking seven guys per nine and holding on to that closer job. But aside from that, you just didn't see that kind of. You don't see that kind of undercutting anymore. And just the way that.
Well, and especially the way he did it. It wasn't like an instant reaction. He wrote in his book, you know, that I saw, what was it? I looked him in his eyes
and there was nobody
saw
home.
That yeah. Nobody was home. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you don't do that. Yeah, that's a guy.
That's a professional hit job.
Yeah. And then, of course, Jose Mesa hit him a bunch of times with him.
Let me tell you something about one more thing about Omar Vizquel. I wrote the Omar Vizquel profile that ran at SI.com a year plus ahead of time. It was written for the Cooperstown casebook. And then I felt it was so negative in the context of everything else that I'd written, which was generally, you know, because the space is limited, I focused on guys who do well by my system, which is why I kept the Vlad Guerrero profile out. It's also why I kept the Omar Vizquel profile. It's not that fun to beat on a guy for not measuring up. That one just felt too negative, but I bought a copy of the Omar's autobiography just so that I could transcribe all that stuff and apply some perspective and use that Jose Mesa situation as a jumping off point. And sorry, I was just turning around to make sure I had the book here. It's so far out of beyond the pale of what we expect from major leaguers these days.
Yeah, it doesn't speak well. It really doesn't. And again, your point is 100% right. Here's how I've come around to this, because look, I've written plenty of things that would be perceived as over the top, including with Jack Morris and others, because I do feel strongly, I don't feel strongly against any player, but I feel strongly against false arguments.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
That bothers me. It's emotional and it shouldn't be. If Omar Vizquel gets voted into the Hall of Fame, I'll celebrate Omar Vizquel. Omar Vizquel is a wonderful player. I have no problem with that. I'm not going to vote for him because I don't think he measures up to where the standard of the Hall of Fame is. And I think there are a lot of people ahead in line of him. If we ever get down to the point where all the guys I think are ahead of line of him are in the Hall of Fame, then it's all systems go. But we're a long way from that. So that's how I feel. I guess for me, the question with him, and so let's bring in Roland and Andrew Jones. Why isn't the same argument? And again, like sort of the skipping in line thing that I feel like Trevor Hoffman did over Billy Wagner. How can you look at Omar Vizquel and say, hey, amazing defense, hit enough? But you don't say the same thing about Andrew Jones or Scott Rolen. I don't understand.
I think this goes back to a Bill James observation that people have a harder time of wrapping their heads around somebody who does many things well rather than one thing well. And it goes back to what we're saying about Larry Walker, who's, you know, one of the ultimate five tool players. Even if it's not commonly thought of as that, maybe because he's white. That Larry Walker was an elite base runner, was an elite defender. At least before his injury, his injuries, and you know, people think just Coors inflated hitting stats when it wasn't that. Roland, you know, is a top 10 or top 15 offensive short third baseman, at worst a top five defensive for third baseman, and possibly top three if you look at the fielding metrics and the Gold Glove count. Both have him third. I mean, that's alarming and rare that they match up so well, even given the fact that yes, the Gold Gloves didn't come along until the late 50s. It matches up very well, and I don't get it. I think the only thing I can think of is that, you know, Scott Rolen never had a huge monster offensive season that people appreciated. You know, a lot of Scott Rolen's value offensively is in good on base percentages, which a lot of people had a hard time seeing, you know, when they saw the you know, I guess modest batting averages that are certainly fine, but we don't really care about batting average anymore.
Right.
You know, 280, 270, 260, so what? You know, it doesn't, like, as long as he's getting those 360 plus on base percentages, it doesn't really matter that much how you get there. So, you know, when you're hitting a lot of home runs and pounding a lot of doubles too. What, you know, I think people also just, they forget what a huge part of those Cardinals teams he was. The 04 and 06 pennant winners and 06 champions. He very easily could have been the MVP of the World Series in 2006, except people who were voting fell in love with the David Eckstein narrative.
Right.
You know, I mean, Scott Rolen went 8-for-19 with 3 doubles and a home run in that World Series with a 1,213 OPS. I mean, what does a guy have to do? I mean, he was great in that series, and he had some other big playoff series. The 2004 NLCS, he was very big for against Houston. You know, that's another one. He had some less than great series too. He was 0-for-15 in the 2004 World Series, so that didn't end well. But nothing was going to stop those Red Sox at that point, I don't think. They were the team of destiny. And you know, he's Rolen was an elite defender on a team that also had Jim Edmonds, who was, you know, I think one of the most fun ball players to watch of his time, and Yadi Molina is behind the plate, and Albert Pujols at a time when Albert Pujols was still, you know, a defensive plus as well as being you know,
a dominant hitter. That's right. I think. You know, we've talked about, I think, enough about Jones, Andrew Jones. To me, the focus on Rolen, I wonder if there's so much of a difference in the way people view a third baseman versus the way people view a shortstop, which is silly if you think about it. They're both, they're both on that side of the field. Right. They play right next to each other. But the fact that Omar Vizquel, because if you look at defensive, you know, just what they did defensively, regardless of position, Scott Rolen was a better defender than Omar Vizquel. You know, I mean, he was a better defender. He put up more fielding runs defensively than Omar Vizquel did. But because Omar Vizquel played short, I don't know that people view it that way. It's almost as if they can't imagine a third baseman being a better defender than a great shortstop. It's weird.
Yeah, it is. And you know, one of the things I looked at is, you know, when you want to separate yourself from the fielding metrics a little bit, or at least the advanced fielding metrics, because I think, you know, there's still maybe a little bit of distrust in them. Getting back to Ozzie Smith on a per nine basis, using just chances per game, putouts and assists per game, was 44/100 a play per game or per nine innings above the average shortstop of his time,
which is a lot.
0.4 per nine. That's basically, you know, a play every other inning, or four plays per nine innings,
It's 70 plays a year.
It's a lot. Omar Vizquel is 0.01 above the average shortstop of his time. These are easy things to look up on Baseball Reference. Scott Rolen is, let's see, range factor per nine, 2.86, and the league was 2.67. So 0.2 plays per nine innings. I mean, it's like that's monstrous. I mean, that's getting to all kinds of balls that other guys didn't get to. And it shows up. And I bet you could probably put Scott Rolen at shortstop for half a season and he would have been fine there. You know, maybe the wear and tear of the position could have broken him down more quickly than you know, he didn't need any help breaking down, especially late in his career. So it might not have held up for very long. But there's no question in my mind you could put Scott Rolen at shortstop and like put Scott Rolen on those Indians teams. Let's see how many World Series they win then. You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that look, I trade him. I trade Omar Vizquel for Scott Rolen every day of the week. So, but there is something to be said about the fielding metrics. You might not agree with them. You might feel like, you know, especially Bill James's big complaint is that Willie Mays is measured in a different way than than the modern center fielder is. I get all of that. I mean, I'm not. There is something behind the fielding metrics, whether you agree with them or not. There's a reason why those metrics are what they are. You might not agree with the methodology. You might not agree with how they do it. You might want to just trust your eyes. I'm looking, watch the game any way you want to watch the game. But there's a reason that Scott Rolen contributed 50 more fielding runs than Omar Vizquel. There is a reason. Whether you agree with the reason or not is not important. Just understand that that's real. That is real. Right. And you know, I like I say, I hope Scott. I don't begrudge Omar Vizquel if he can convince 75% of the people to vote for him. I have no issues with that. But I do have issues with Scott Rolen not getting more support, and I hope he gets it. I really think
one thing I was heartened by is that, you know, there were a number of people either in their columns or their tweets or conversations that I had who, you know, who maybe voted before giving Scott Rolen, I think, a fully fair shake and say, I want to look harder at this guy next year. You know, I may have, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I missed the boat there. Let me go back and take a look next year when we've got a little bit more space on the ballot. And so I think he goes upwards from here. Obviously, you know, the historical precedents for people starting their Hall of Fame ballot tenures with 10% and getting to the Hall of Fame are pretty slim. It's a lot of guys who got in on the Veterans Committee ballots, you know, or whatever. But I do think he goes up. I do think Andrew Jones goes up. One thing I will say, getting back to the Bill James thing and the total zone, which is what we have for pre-defensive run save stuff that starts in 2003, actually holds, you know, and what we have basically for most of baseball history, which is just based on, you know, ball, you know, static balls in play and inferred location data, still has Andrew Jones ahead of Willie Mays. And, you know, we're using the same sources of data. Maybe it's a little bit less granular in Willie Mays' time, but, you know, it's still like he Andrew Jones still does better by that method of measurement than Mays. So it's not like a completely ridiculous thing. He just, you know, if you're apportioning credit to, you know, to the Braves defense for preventing runs because the pitchers weren't doing it all themselves, the credit has to go there. And the gap between what the Braves should have been allowing and what they did allow over that time span is such that the lion's share of the credit has to go to him.
Well, and I don't think anybody, Bill James included, believes that he was anything other than a great, great defensive center fielder. I don't want to try to break down Bill's argument here. I think it was much more along the lines of trying to build gigantic cases, like the fact that he is the greatest defensive center fielder of all time. On statistics that are you know not necessarily as strong as you would like them to be, but we can discuss that another time. Jay, this is always fun to geek out about the Hall of Fame with you. Hopefully, we'll do that again soon. Thanks for joining.
Hey, a pleasure, Joe. It's always fun to talk Hall with you and talk baseball in general.
All right, Mike. So that was me and Jay Jaffe talking about the Hall of Fame. You'll have to listen to that. It was cool. Jay's smart. Jay's a smart dude.
Yeah, smart person. Yeah,
very smart person. Very cool. All right. So we're going to close this out, and we are looking for ways to close these things out. We've decided to close it out with book club.
That's right.
Book club. That's what we're doing this week is book club, where we'll each recommend a book. We'll see how long this lasts. I see this as a one week deal, but we only have a couple of minutes. So,
but we're trying to close all of our podcasts with a different thing. We're in search of a thing to replace what used to be one last meaningless thing to end this meaningless thing. And so we've tried, what have we tried so far? Let's quickly. We've tried gripes.
Right? A lot of people liked gripes, by the way. I thought it was a little negative, really? A little negative. I thought a lot of people
downbeat, right?
Yeah, we don't want to do that. And then
what else have we tried? I forget everything that we've done.
Baseball players that just came to mind, like
all right,
baseball. We did inventions we love. I know we've done that one. We've done like three or four others. I can't remember them all. one thing we could do, I mean, we actually talked last week about just insulting Keith Law. We thought like we would just end this thing by doing that, which is super fun.
Let's do that next week. We're going to next week will be insult Keith Law.
Insult Keith Law. But book club. So what is your book?
So there's a book coming out called All the Pieces Matter. The Inside Story of The Wire. Oh, really?
Yeah. No, but that's fine.
Yeah. So it was written by Jonathan Abrams. I was asked to blurb this book, which was that's a very so high exciting. Honor. Rarely happened to me in my life. And I did blurb it. It's a sort of oral history of the making of The Wire. It's a wonderful book. It is better if you've seen The Wire. Like you'll enjoy it more if you've seen the show. But I have to say that what was so fun about reading it is it's fun to just learn. It's a good book to read if you just want to learn about like how TV is made. Like if you're interested in the process of making TV from like conception and idea all the way through execution and like series finale, you get a really good sort of view of the whole. It's like a bird's eye view of the entire show being put together through the voices of the people who actually made it and started it and all that sort of stuff. So highly recommend it. I don't think it's out yet. It's coming out very soon. But that's my official podcast book club recommendation, All the Pieces Matter by Jonathan Abrams.
Yeah, you took mine. So here's the deal with Jonathan, who is a fantastic writer. I'd say about, 6 months ago, maybe even a little longer ago, maybe a year ago, I get an email just out of nowhere from Jonathan, who I'd never met. And, I'd followed his writing. He was at Grantland. He's now at Bleacher Report. He was at the New York Times. And I followed his writing. I thought it was great. And I get an email from him saying, hey, wanted to introduce myself. I'm Jonathan Abrams, big fan of your work and would love to get together. I live down the street.
Really?
He literally lives like 8 houses away from me, Jonathan does.
That's hilarious.
And here's the best part. You know how he found out? He found out because his wife was in a book club in the neighborhood. And she was telling people, hey, yeah, you know, my husband's a sports writer. And like, you know, there's another sports writer in the neighborhood. I don't know if they know each other. And so she didn't know me at the time. We have now become great friends, all of us. But she came home and she said, do you know a guy named Joe Posnansky? And he's like, yeah, he's kind of a big deal. And she said, I guess he lives on our street. So, you know, and of course that was the same way I felt. I'm like, yeah, Jonathan Abrams. Yeah. He's kind of a big deal. And so anyway, awesome. That book is fantastic. I'm hoping he will be my interview next week. In fact,
as the book
comes out. So very exciting. So that was going to be mine as well. But since you chose that one, I should probably pick another one. I'm going to pick, I'm not trying to now look up the title of it because it was really, really good. It's a book called Little Fires Everywhere. Have you heard of this by Celeste Ng? Yeah, it's a novel. And I was drawn to it because it is about a family. It's more than a family, but a family in Shaker Heights, Ohio, which is literally the next suburb over from where I grew up, and the much better suburb than where I grew up. But I don't know if it's better, but it's much more. It was sort of the richer suburb, and which is a big part of the book. But anyway, it's a wonderful book about this family and what's underneath, and you know what you know it means to be wealthy, but also what it means to want to have sort of a social conscience. And anyway, it's fantastic. It's called Little Fires Everywhere. I wish I read more novels. I'd love to do that. I don't get the opportunity to read as many. So when a really good one comes across, I'd love to recommend it. So Little Fires Everywhere. If you'd like to read that, I like this, by the way. I like this idea. Like we just
book club.
Yeah, book club. I like book club. Let's see how the people feel about it. Right. But all right. Well, as always, Michael, thank you.
Thanks for having me.